Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Anthony Cronman. He is Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School, where he was also for a number of years dean. And he says that for the past 40 years or so, he's been a student, a teacher, and a dean. And he says for all of that time, and in all of the different roles he's occupied in his career, he says his deepest belief has remained unchanged, and that is that a college or university is not just a place for the transmission of knowledge, but should be a forum for the exploration of life's mystery and meaning. And he says the thing that concerns him now, and the reason that we're talking this morning, is that over time, this question, the question of life's meaning, has lost its status as a subject of organized academic instruction. He says it's been pushed to the margins of professional respectability in the humanities, where it once occupied a central and honored place. We will talk this morning, try to talk, about what has happened and why, and what it means for both higher education and the culture. And these are all questions that Anthony Cronman explores in his book, Education's End. The subtitle is Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life. The book is published by the Yale University Press. It came out last fall. I'm sure that you can find it in the library or the bookstore if you're interested in reading the book. And on our program here this morning, of course, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that they are brief as they can be, just so that we can accommodate as many different people and keep our program moving along. But, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, calls are welcome. Professor Cronman, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
You point out here in the introduction to the book and early on that sometimes we like to poke fun at people who seem to be preoccupied with this question, or maybe it is that we like to poke fun at people who pursue it in a humorless way. Maybe that's more correct. But, you know, having said that, let me ask you, how often in your daily life do you pause to consider or ask yourself the question, what is life all about?
Well, about as often, I suspect, as most people do, which is not very often. But it's a question that is there in the background of our lives always, all the time. And from time to time, under the pressure of events and experience, it pushes its way to the center of the stage. And when it does, has a way of taking over the whole of our lives, at least for a brief period of time.
Hmm. This is something that in the Western classical tradition, or at least in the Western classical tradition of philosophy, it has been a central question. That is essentially this question, how are we to live our lives, in what way, and why does it matter how we live our lives?
Yes, exactly so. Just this morning, I was rereading the opening book of Plato's Republic in preparation for teaching it to a group of students this afternoon. And I was struck again, as I had been before, by a particular passage in which one of Socrates' companions says something rather emphatic and then gets up and is about to leave the conversation, and Socrates says, are you just going to leave now with a question of such importance on the table? And isn't the question that we're discussing the question of what one should care about and how one ought to live? And can there be a question ultimately of greater consequence than that? And I was just struck again very forcefully by the Socratic formulation of that idea, which of course echoes down the centuries in the great works of philosophy and literature and the great works of art that make up together what we think of as the Western tradition or Western civilization.
For anyone listening who might be scratching their heads and might say, well, I think maybe I know what it is you're talking about, let me ask you right out, what is it that we're talking about here. When one asks that question, what's the good life? How should one live? Are we talking about personal morality? Are we talking about relations between individuals? Are we talking about the individual and society? Are we talking about what it is you choose to do with your life in terms of your career, how you spend your free time? What really are we talking about?
Can I answer all of the above?
That would be that's an acceptable. Yeah, D, all of the above. Yes, you can do that.
One way I think of putting the question, a way that may be a bit more manageable and a bit more familiar, is the following: the question of life's meaning is the question of what ultimately I care about or ought to care about. A life, every person's life is organized around a set of cares. I care about my family. I care about my work. If I'm a religious person, I care about my God. I care about my community, the political society to which I belong, and so on and so forth. And in every person's life, the cares or concerns, the commitments that organize it and give it its direction and structure form a kind of hierarchy or pyramid, but by which I mean very simply that some cares are more important. I care about keeping my hair at manageable length, but I care about that less than I care about the welfare of my children. At the top of everyone's hierarchy of cares, there will be one or two or several things which are of ultimate importance to them for the sake of which they're living their lives. And those obviously aren't the same and needn't be the same for everyone. But the question of what ought to be at the pinnacle of the hierarchy of cares in one's life is a question that we all confront from time to time in our lives. And my conception of a classical education is that it gives us some equipment to help us grapple with that question when in the dark hour or the bright afternoon it presents itself and we find ourselves face to face with matters of what the theologian Paul Tillich called ultimate concern.
It seems to me that these kinds of questions that university students have been asking themselves and each other these kind of questions for a long time, and whether that has to do with being in university or whether it has something to do with that time in one's life or whether it's a little bit of both, that's always been a feature of student life. Do you think, though, that it is any less true, any less a feature of student life today than it might have been, say, when you were an undergraduate or even going back further?
Well, that's a terrific question, and I'm going to answer it in two ways, yes and no. Of course, you're absolutely right. A young person, 17, 18, 19 years old, climbing out of the travails of adolescence on the threshold of maturity, but not yet in a job, not yet married in most cases, or burdened with a mortgage and the realities of adult life, will be filled with an exuberant curiosity about life. And there's just a driving energy there that has always been there and will always be there. So the after-class dormitory bull sessions where students sit around and talk about the meaning of life or over coffee with their professor after class discuss it, that is a permanent feature of college and university life that I just can't imagine will ever disappear. What has disappeared, and this is the source of my concern and really the subject of the book, is the focused attention which these same questions once received in the classroom. Once upon a time, a half century or so ago, the question of life's meaning wasn't just a topic for informal extracurricular, often very intense, but extracurricular conversations and debates and arguments, but for studious attention, discussion, debate, and exploration within the more structured framework of the classroom itself. And I think of these two forums, if I can put it that way, for the exploration of the questions of ultimate meaning as complementary. The classroom with its special discipline and organized approach can provide young people with a working arsenal of ideas, arguments, images, intellectual experiences, which become their possession and they can then use in whatever way seems best to them in the personal conversations that continue on after class. That classroom-focused attention to the question, though, is what has diminished, declined, been pushed to the margin of things in higher education, in my view.
Mm. I have a caller here, and I'll get to this person. I want to make sure that they know I'm not going to wait, make them wait forever. But before then, let me just ask you to talk for a moment or two about why you think that this has happened.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of different causes, but the one that I emphasize in my book is the rise of what I call the modern research ideal. Any college teacher in any discipline, including the humanities, knows today that in order to make his or her way professionally, which is to say to get an appointment, to be promoted, to achieve respect among one's colleagues in whatever field one happens to be teaching in, the road to success is specialized research. You've got to become an expert in some small sliver of the intellectual territory that you've chosen, and then add your small brick of discovery, invention, original criticism to the stockpile in your field. That's how you make a name and a reputation for yourself. But the emphasis on specialization, which that approach entails, leads away from the great, messy, sprawling, very personal questions of life's meaning, which from the standpoint of the research ideal look unmanageably large and incohate. They look like dilettante's questions, not the sort of thing that a responsible teacher would take up in his or her research or in discussion with students in class, best left to the midnight bull sessions, but not a fit subject for classroom instruction. That, I think, has been a, if not the, fundamental moving cause of the devaluation of the great questions of life's meaning as a subject of classroom instruction.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Anthony Cronman. He is Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Since stepping down as dean of the law school in 2004, he's been teaching in the Directed Studies program at Yale and devoting himself to the humanities. His book, if you would like to read it, is Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here to bring into the conversation. In Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I especially agree with your last point regarding research and, quote, legitimate research, and that being one reason the broader issues aren't covered. But I want to bring up, a few comments about your earlier points and then get off the phone and let you answer on air. The first is, it was interesting that when you summarized, you used the point Western traditions. And I think that in itself is a great narrowing of the perspectives that one can have to explore these issues. And I think it's an unfortunate one that creates a blindness in how and what is examined in order to grapple with the issues of meaning and so forth. It's also was interesting to me to hear you say when you talked about literature and art, but you left out religion, even though later you did bring up Tillich and some other religious figures. And I think we have to acknowledge that both in the West and the so-called East, in the North and the so-called South, whether we're talking about in Asia or South America or Africa, etc., religion in all the various forms of what we call religion is often grappling more directly and succinctly with these issues that you're bringing up. And building on that, I'll go to my third point, and that's my last point, is that I think an important issue or matter to also reflect on is how does one grapple with issues of meaning? Obviously, in the university, the primary focus is classrooms, intellectual and conceptual verbal discussion. Now, of course, with art, it's slightly different, but still, that's the primary focus. And I would like to at least raise the point, the perspective that there are many other ways, both in Western and in other traditions, Eastern, Southern, etc., where there are other means and other methods for grappling with the issues of meaning, which, when we try to grapple with them primarily or only in conceptual and intellectual terms, we actually miss what the primary points of these traditions and perspectives are. I hope, is that all clear? And if it is, then I'll just get off the air.
Yes, very, very clear. And okay. Thank you for your comments and questions. If I might, I'll take your three points in reverse order. They're all good points, and I'm in substantial agreement with much of what you say, though I think there are probably at least shades of difference in the way we think about or approach these matters. First, of course you're right. There isn't just one way of approaching or coming to terms with the question of life's meaning. And the way that colleges and universities offer is certainly not the only or exclusive one. But it is the one they are best equipped and best suited to supply. That's because, as you correctly say, they operate in the medium of ideas and arguments and intellectual analysis. So while it would be a mistake to think that the only way of preparing yourself to come to terms with questions of ultimate meaning is to study them in an academic setting, the way they are studied in school is one of the central and essential methods or techniques for approaching them, and it is the one that colleges and universities, as I say, are best set up to provide. There is a kind of moral or spiritual division of labor at work here, and I think colleges and universities should be encouraged to do what they're best able to do, which is to approach these questions discursively, intellectually, verbally, intellectually. Now, secondly, with regard to religion, of course you're right there as well, and in a couple of ways. No one, just to stick with the civilization of the West for a minute, no one can begin to understand or appreciate the foundational texts and works of Western culture without an appreciation of the ways in which religious views, beliefs, and sentiments have entered into their construction. So much of the literature and philosophy and art of the West is suffused with religious belief and feeling that it would just be impossible to come to terms with them without an understanding of their religious character and inspiration. And religion itself, as a a set of institutions or practices or traditions is itself a vital component of the culture of the West. And I would think that any young person who wanted to be at home in that culture would need to understand in at least a moderately knowledgeable and sophisticated way something about the three Abrahamic religions in particular, Judaism, Islam, and most centrally Christianity, which have played a shaping role in the development of the West. Finally, with regard to your first point about my emphasis on the West in particular to the apparent exclusion of the world's other great civilizations, I would say a couple of things. First, the civilization of the West is, if I may put it this way, the home civilization of the vast majority of students in our colleges and universities today, and I think it very important that they be at home in that civilization, whatever interest in or understanding of the world's other great civilizations they also acquire. And I say that because so many college and university students today take a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They take one course in the history of early modern China, another course on Mayan architecture, a third course on Islamic politics, and a a fourth course on medieval European philosophy, and they end up without a coherent appreciation of any of the world's great civilizations, each of which has its own internal integrity and unity continuity over centuries and centuries of time. And to be a participant in the conversation of any of these civilizations, one must have studied it and its development at some considerable length. Of course, in the world that we live in today, which is a cosmopolis, a global civilization made up of men and women from many different traditions, each of which has its own claimed, quite proper claim to greatness, it's not enough to be acquainted with just one of these. It is essential, even if you begin by rooting yourself in your own home tradition or culture of the West, to develop at least a responsibly solid understanding of some one or ones of the other civilizations that are vibrant living cultures in the world today. So I would actually, if I could write on a blank sheet and had the powers of an educational dictator, I would not only require college and university students to spend a year studying the civilization of the West, I would require them to spend a second year studying one of the world's other great civilizations, the civilization of China, perhaps, or India, or Japan, or Islam, so that they would be educated, thoughtful, prepared citizens of the global cosmopolis we inhabit today.
Just very quickly, and I have some other callers I want to get to, but I want to follow up on one point that follows from the comment of the caller about the significance of religion as a means to or a framework to discussing these kinds of questions. You also seem, I think, to be arguing that that perhaps it's not an altogether good thing if colleges and universities withdraw from the field, so to speak, on this question and leave it to religion.
Yes, absolutely right. And thank you for that comment. When our colleges and universities gave up on the question of life's meaning as a subject of serious and organized study in the classroom, the question didn't vanish. People didn't lose interest in it. But increasingly, they found that they had only the churches to look to for instruction, guidance, assistance of an organized kind in their search for an answer to the question. And our churches have been and always will be in the business of offering instruction in the meaning of life. That's what they're there to do. And that, of course, is a good and wonderful thing. But our culture as a whole would be healthier, I believe, if the churches had some competition from our colleges and universities, which, of course, can't and shouldn't ask from their students a declaration of faith in the way our churches do, but can nevertheless approach spiritual questions in a serious but undogmatic way. And that's what I would like to see our colleges and universities do again, what they once did and I think could do again. And if they did, it would be to the good of all of us, the faithful and the agnostic.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580 Anthony Cronman. He's Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He also has been the dean there. And if you'd like to read more of his thinking on this subject, you can look for his book, Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life, published last fall by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, the number, if you'd like to join the conversation, and you're in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Earlier in the show, you used two words, care and equipment. It kind of sounds Heideggerian, existentialist. And I was just wondering if that might not be one area where universities could focus on the questions that you're trying to address. And I guess that's my question. I mean, are the universities across the nation focusing enough on some of the questions that were brought forward by the existential thinkers?
Well, you're absolutely right, and you caught the resonance and the reference in the words that I was using. The question of life's meaning was very much at the center of attention of the great existentialist European philosophical writers of the middle decades of the last century. And a study of their work would be a proper and an important part of the kind of program that I'm encouraging and promoting. But in this regard, the existentialists were really no different fundamentally from their 18th century or 16th century forebears in the same philosophical tradition, or for that matter, from the great philosophers of Greek and Roman antiquity, who were also very much concerned centrally with the same questions. Plato and Aristotle and the great Stoic writers, Cicero and Seneca, were focused above all else on the question, how ought a human being to live his or her life, organized around what set of ultimate directing cares and concerns. Of course, they answered that question differently than the existentialists of the 20th century did, but although their answers were different, the question was pretty much the same. And my own feeling about this is that it's not the place of a college or university to tell its students what the answer to the question of life's meaning is, as if there were a single answer and it could be conveyed in a sentence or two, but instead to give students an inventory of some or several, many of the enduringly most attractive, the perennially exciting and credible answers to this question that different men and women have given over the course of human history. And these answers are not only different but conflicting, and many of them are incompatible with one another. But to if I may speak metaphorically, to fill up the student's mind and soul as if it were a granary that could be drawn on, tapped into in later years as they confront the question in one form or another, in one context or another, and remembering back and retrieving the images and ideas and characters and arguments and paintings and so on, which they've stored away, to find comfort and direction and provocation, inspiration in the accumulated life wisdom, which as a young person of 19 or 20, not yet knowing what they'd make of it, they packed away for a later rainy day.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, especially if you're approaching it from the background of the Greek tradition. Although, you know, the earlier existentialists like Pascal and then finally articulated by Kierkegaard, you know, brought in ideas of faith. And, you know, the example he uses in Fear and Trembling is, you know, how could Abraham sacrifice his son?
Right.
And he kind of contrasts that. You know, how would Hegel have answered that question, or Descartes,
right,
or the Greeks? And it's a very interesting idea. But it seems like existential courses might be the place to where a university could actually focus on some of these ideas without trying to convert anybody at the door.
Yes,
but anyway,
exactly. That's very well said. You may be interested to know that in the directed studies program in which I teach at Yale, this is a freshman program which is intended to give students a pretty broad introduction to some of the main ideas and greatest works in Western civilization. In the spring term, we begin with Descartes in the philosophy section of the program, and toward the end, we read Fear and Trembling by Kierkegaard, and I have always felt that in teaching that book in particular, my challenge in the classroom was, without being dogmatic or doctrinaire, to help students appreciate and come to terms with the immensity of the spiritual challenge that work poses, to teach its deep religiosity without being myself a teacher of religious dogma, if I can put it, if that's not too paradoxical or confusing a way to put it.
We have a couple of other callers here, and we're now moving into our last 15 minutes. So again, callers will help us by being brief. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go to Bloomington, Indiana next, line 4. Hello.
Hi. About the purpose of life, if life is just a cosmic accident, as our public schools teach, then life has no purpose. But if life is the creation of a God who stays involved in his creation, then life has a profound purpose, and that purpose is to carry out the purpose for which God made us. It's amazing to me that atheism comes from our public schools, and yet the existence of God is proven by such overwhelming scientific evidence. Our public schools should be teaching science, and science has made it virtually impossible to deny the existence of God. Certainly, you have heard the simple proof of God's existence based on the fact that the universe is not eternal. The fact that the universe had a beginning proves there's God? Do you know that proof? Hello?
The question of whether the world had a beginning in time or not is, of course, an ancient philosophical puzzle, but it's a contemporary. If the little I know about debates in modern cosmology, are at all the little bit that I know is at all correct, the question of whether the universe had a beginning in time or is eternal,
yes,
remains as alive today as it was for Plato and Aristotle and Augustine, who disagreed on this question.
It's a very simple proof. One paragraph will do it. But God came right out of the Big Bang, because anything which has a beginning is subject to the scientific law of cause and effect. You know, as long as scientists viewed the universe as eternal, they could claim that this eternal universe needed no cause, just like eternal God needs no cause. But a universe that had a beginning must have a cause, and where the universe is involved, this cause, only an eternal cause could be the cause of the universe, because if the universe had a cause that was not eternal, then that cause would also need a cause.
I'm going to jump in here because, I think whether God exists or not is a little bit beyond the scope of this program. I do, however, though, want to give you the opportunity to address the assertion, and I'm sure that a lot of other people would make it, that essentially public education is an essentially atheist operation, and that somehow there is no consideration of religion or religious values, that in fact its intent is to indoctrinate people to be atheists.
Yeah. Well, this is a very large and complicated and controversial subject. Our public schools are, required to maintain their distance from anything that might even remotely be described as religious indoctrination. They're required by the Constitution of the United States to do so. And if that were all that one meant by describing our public schools as being secular institutions, I think many fewer people would object to the kind of education they offer today than do. But of course, I think with some legitimacy, our public schools can be described not merely in a negative way as keeping their distance from religion, but more positively as promoting or encouraging a secular scientific view of the world and of human beings, which itself, in the eyes of some, represents as much a religious dogma in secular terms as the more avowedly and explicitly forms of religious expression clearly do. I'm not unsympathetic to that criticism or complaint, and would actually myself, for what it's worth, favor both at the high school level and also certainly in college the introduction of courses which raise in a direct and deliberate and thoughtful way the question of whether the competition, as it's sometimes styled, between science and religion isn't at bottom a conflict or a contradiction between two very different views of the world and two very different ways of answering the fundamental questions of life's meaning. I would only insist, for my part, that the secular scientific position also represents as much a spiritual conception of man's place in the world as the traditional religions do that it rejects or repudiates. The belief, to make that last point just a bit more concrete, the scientist's belief that the world has an intelligible structure which reveals itself to the inquiring human mind as we probe more deeply into its processes and laws. That assumption rests on a profound belief in the possibility and value of rational inquiry, of reason itself. And that needn't, although for some scientists it is, that needn't be backed up by a belief in a creator God who made the world and its laws from nothing. There are many scientists who reject that belief but hold to their rationalism as to a kind of spiritual faith. And I think that for a young person to inspect that ideal closely and to compare it religious forms of understanding and expression, to see the points of similarity and difference, can do nothing but good for that young person's own spiritual development and put them in a better and more enlightened position to figure out where they stand with respect to these ultimate questions.
We just have about 5-6 minutes left. I want to get on to another caller here. This is Effingham, and it's line 2. Hello.
Yes, I'll try to keep it short. The addressing of the material world, finite, infinite, the dialectic between those things, the subject of the conversation being, I think, if I understand right, the student, and the student who is not a fully developed adult, and how we teach the child, how we teach from the beginning, you know, from the beginning of life, babe in arms, clear through until upper adulthood, which is very remote now, I think. But it is that we must accept that this is a finite world, and all the things in it, life, if all of it is finite. It continues on, but global warming is giving us now the reduction of the material species, and humans are not exempt from that. I hope it's not too much, but thank you, and I'll ring off.
Well, you can, Professor Graham, you can react to that any way,
sure,
way you like.
Sure. It is the fact that our lives here on Earth, whether you believe in a world to come and a life after this one or not, it is a fact which we all acknowledge grudgingly, I suppose, that our lives here on Earth are finite. They are limited. They have a beginning and an end. We all come into the world and one day disappear from it. That isn't something we think about much most of the time, like the question of life's meaning. But it is our own mortality, our finitude, which hangs over us like a shadow, and more so the older we get and the more appreciative of how precious and valuable the time that we have is. It's that phenomenon, that condition, that experience that is the source, the primal source of the need to ask the question, what sense can I make of this transient life that I find myself living, that I'm in the middle of? What can possibly explain it? What purpose might it have? What direction should it have? What ought I to care about? If we lived forever, the question of what to care about would be less important, if it would have any importance at all. You might decide for the first billion years to care about one thing and then change course and care about something altogether different. Things matter to us. They have urgency and importance. They're worth caring about. We feel the need to identify our ultimate cares only because life is finite. That's what puts the pressure on us. And of course, a young person, 18, 19 years old, in his or her freshman year of college, is only dimly aware, out of the corner of their eye, so to speak, of their own mortality. And these questions of ultimate meaning may not, for them at that stage in life, have the bite and urgency that they will later on. But as I said before, they can very usefully fill their granary of ideas and images and insights, so that when their mortality begins to bear in on them in later years, they'll have some resources to fall back on in thinking about how to confront it and what to make of the fact of their own mortal existence.
Let me just ask you a practical and dull question, and that is, it's difficult enough now during the course of an undergraduate career to get a thorough grounding in whatever discipline that you're going to concentrate on. If we do what it sounds to me like maybe you would like to see us do, and that is to develop a fairly broad-based humanities curriculum requirement that all students would take, and also if we consider the fact that we have this idea that one shouldn't exclusively just study your own discipline, but no matter what it is you concentrate on, we'd like you to have some experience with some things outside, the idea being that you're going to be somewhat rounded. It seems to me like we're talking about adding to the burden, the cost, the length of being an undergraduate to the point where we could be adding at least another year to what it would take somebody to get through just to get their bachelor's degree.
Well, that's a fair point, David, and a reasonable concern. But I think the pressures that you've described are somewhat overstated. Even for a student who knows what he or she wants to do after college and feels the need to begin to get prepared for that by taking some number of courses that will get them headed in the right direction. They want to be a lawyer or a doctor or a businessman, an architect, whatever. They need to pick a major to develop some more focused knowledge of a particular field, and they need to begin to get ready for their post-collegiate professional life. Really, to do all of that needn't require more than, I would say, a rather modest fraction of the number of courses and number of hours that you have to spend during your 4 years in college. To prepare for law school, there really are no courses that you absolutely must take. There are probably four or five, half a dozen that you should. You could major in economics and take all of the other courses that would put you in a solid position to be a crack law student and still have two-thirds or three-quarters of your disposable, available courses left over. And my plea is just that some smallish fraction of those, two or three out of a total of typically 35, 36, 38, that two or three of those be devoted to the kind of program that I'm proposing.
We have one more caller here. I want to give them a chance real quick. We'll go to Sullivan, line four. Hello.
Yes. Just to conclude this, obviously you're a man that's had a lot of experience. And what is your meaning of life for you personally? I'd like to know, of all the studying that you've done and this analyst and how you think everybody should do this, tell me what your purpose of life is and your meaning of life. What do you think the meaning of life is?
Okay, and I can give you a minute to give us the meaning of life.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, I don't think anyone's done a better job by my own lights of answering that question than Sigmund Freud, the great psychoanalyst, when he was asked just that. And he said, the meaning of life, it's to love and to work, to be creative in your work, fulfilled in your work, to feel that you are repaying the world in some fashion for the miraculous gift of your existence, and to be able to love and to return the love that others have given you and that allowed you to flourish in the first place. So I would say to love and to work. And for me, that means most fundamentally my family, my wife, my children, my parents, and my teaching, which is my work.
And do you think that the kind of argument that you make about returning to these kinds of questions to not just something that people pursue in their off time, but something that in a disciplined and deliberate way is taken up in the classroom. Is there some chance that that's going to gain a hold? I'm sure there are already people across the country, colleges and universities, who would agree with you, who would say, well, sure, I think that that's fine. But there's a difference between that and actually putting that into some sort of more formal kind of program for students.
I'm actually pretty optimistic about a renaissance of the kind that I imagine in my book. Though the modern research ideal pushes us all in the direction of greater and greater specialization, many, many of my colleagues here at Yale and teachers at other schools that I've spoken with have a pent-up longing to get back to the fundamentals in their discipline, the things about it that first drew them to it when they were young and entering teaching themselves, and then to convey some of that great excitement to other young people who are just coming into it themselves. So I think that I think the tide is turning. It's not going to happen through top-down management, mandatory courses, and the like. It will happen because teachers here and there will gather and begin to construct voluntary, discretionary programs organized around these ideas, and the students will flock to them because the students want these programs badly. I believe that to be true.
Right.
And their success will cause them to be a magnet that will draw others.
Our guest, Anthony Cronman, is Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School. His book is Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life, published by the Yale University Press. Professor Cronman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Also, our thanks to Phil Kearney, who's the technical guy on the other end of our connection there with Yale.